Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the U.S. wants and expects Israel to shift its military operations in Gaza to a lower intensity phase.
It's clear that the conflict will move and needs to move.
Plus, the top leader of Hamas was in Egypt for talks Wednesday on halting the war in Gaza.
They are working Egypt, Qatar, the United States, Israel on another humanitarian pause.
And the Colorado Supreme Court issued a ruling late Tuesday that former President Donald Trump should not appear on Colorado's ballot. Today is Thursday, December 21st. And this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Wednesday that the U.S. wants and expects Israel to shift its military operations in Gaza to a lower intensity phase, during which there will be more targeted operations focused on the Hamas leadership and its infrastructure.
It's clear that the conflict will move and needs to move to a lower intensity phase. And we expect to see and want to see a shift to more targeted operations with a smaller number of forces that's really focused in on dealing with the leadership, Hamas, the tunnel network, and a few other critical things. And as that happens, I think you'll see as well the harm done to civilians also decrease significantly.
Israel has faced increasing pressure from its Western allies to curb a military onslaught in Gaza that has laid waste to much of the densely populated coastal enclave in retaliation for the Hamas killing and kidnapping spree on October 7th. Blinken said he was also struck by what he described as an absence of demands by other countries for Hamas to lay down its weapons, and he called for pressure on the Islamist group to take steps to end the war. The top leader of Hamas was in Egypt for talks Wednesday on halting the war in Gaza and securing the release of at least some of the estimated 129 Israeli captives held by Palestinian militants. I spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein about this and other developments in the Israel-Hamas war.
There's not a lot of expectation that this is going to happen quickly or easily. In fact, President Biden said that it's not something that's going to happen imminently. But they are working Egypt, Qatar, the United States, Israel on another humanitarian pause, and during which about somewhere between 30 and 40 of the hostages would be released. Yesterday, both Hamas and Islamic Jihad published propaganda video showing some of the hostages. In the Hamas one, had three of the older men. One, I think, is over 80. One is in his late 70s and saying that they wanted to be released. And Islamic Jihad also had a video with two people. And there really is a sense that time is running out for the hostages and that either they will die from medical care or lack of food, or like the tragic accident that happened a few days ago in which an Israeli soldier killed three of the hostages who managed to escape. On that issue, by the way, Israeli television tonight published an interview with the mother of one of those three who said she does not blame the Israeli soldiers who shot him. She only blames Hamas, and she told the Israeli soldiers not to hesitate to shoot if they feel that Hamas or if they're feeling threatened. It was quite a remarkable interview to hear for the mother of someone whose son was shot by mistake by Israeli soldiers.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu once again said that they will not stop fighting until the achieve all the goals they have set, and that includes the elimination of Hamas, the release of the hostages, and the removal of the threat from Gaza.
Now it's 75 days into the war, and Israel has not managed to assassinate any of the top Hamas leaders. They say that they've come close several times. In addition, there has not been rocket fire in the last 24 hours, but that's probably because of the hostage talks. Hamas still has the ability to fire rockets. There's a growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. There's growing displacement of people who have nowhere to go back to. So, yes, that's what Netanyahu's saying. At the same time, the United States is also privately urging him to try to switch tactics, take some of the reserve troops out of Gaza, and to carry out pinpoint attacks on Hamas leaders rather than these sort of widespread air and ground attacks that have been going on now for almost 2 months.
Linda, the UN is saying that 9 out of 10 people are without food in Gaza, and that 66% of Gazans who had a job before the war are now employed. And Israel is saying that it wants to fast-track humanitarian aid to Gaza via a maritime corridor from Cyprus.
Yes, I mean, there's really growing concern that people really don't have enough food to eat. And Israel says that it is letting humanitarian aid in, that it's a distribution problem, that the UN simply doesn't have the distribution network in these places, especially in the south of Gaza, where so many people are concentrated.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein. The Colorado Supreme Court issued a ruling late Tuesday that former President Donald Trump should not appear on Colorado's ballot because of his alleged role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Citing the 14th Amendment's Insurrection Clause, the 4-3 ruling by the Colorado justices found that Trump engaged in an insurrection by promoting false claims of election fraud and encouraging supporters to go to the Capitol on that day. To help us understand how the Colorado Supreme Court is applying the 14th Amendment to the office of the president, VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Joel Paul, professor of law at the University of California, Hastings.
The 14th Amendment is one of the three post-Civil War amendments adopted by Congress to basically undo the system of slavery and racial segregation that existed before the Civil War. The 14th Amendment ensures the rights of freed African Americans, and it also provides in Section 3 that persons who were officials of the government, either the state government or the national government, and who took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and who nevertheless participated in the insurrection, are ineligible to hold any office in the United States.
So looking at Trump as being president of the United States, one of the issues is that he is an officer in the United States in the context in which that term is used in Article 3 of the 14th Amendment. So how do they still interpret this?
Right. So it's a little bit confusing. The district court in Colorado initially held that Trump had participated in an insurrection, that his incitement of the riot at the Capitol constituted an insurrection, as well as his attempts to participate in a scheme to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. However, the district court said that Article 3 did not apply to the president, that he wasn't, for this purpose, an officer of the United States. The Supreme Court in Colorado reversed that and said, yes, of course he's an officer of the United States. The plain language of the Constitution suggests that he's an officer of the United States. And therefore, they held that he was ineligible to have his name on the Colorado ballot.
And the U.S. Supreme Court, if it agrees to take up Trump's expected appeal, how will this ruling apply to the general election?
Well, there are a couple of issues the Supreme Court has to face. One issue is whether, in fact, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment actually does apply to the President of the United States. I think that's an easy answer, and the answer is yes. But the other issues they have to confront are whether or not the President did, in fact, participate in an insurrection, and whether President Trump can be held ineligible by the Colorado Supreme Court, or whether there is some other body that should make that decision. If the Supreme Court decides, for example, that the president did participate in an insurrection and therefore should not be permitted on the ballot in Colorado, that would bar him from the Colorado ballot. And there are several other suits pending in various other state courts to have him kept off the ballot in those states. In California, for example, the attorney general has gone to court to argue that that Trump should not be permitted on the ballot. So we might see a number of states in similar situations. Whether or not the Supreme Court will decide the case at all is a question, because they have to decide the case by January 4th. January 5th is the latest deadline by which Trump's name could appear on the primary ballot in Colorado under state law. And so if they don't decide the case by January 4th, the case becomes moot.
That was VOA's Kim Lewis speaking with Joel Paul, professor of law at the University of California, Hastings. We're also following these stories from around the world. The U.S. has secured the freedom of 10 Americans from Venezuelan prisons in exchange for the release of a close ally of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. A U.S. court on Wednesday unsealed an indictment charging an alleged senior Hezbollah operative with terrorism, in part for coordinating a 1994 bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires that killed 85 people. Temperatures plunging to minus 15 degrees Celsius Wednesday added to the miseries for Chinese villagers who lost their homes after a magnitude 6.2 earthquake Monday night. More than 145,000 people were homeless in Gansu province. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. As Russia's war on Ukraine drags on, the humanitarian aspects are of increasing concern. Lisa Schlein in Geneva tells VOA's Lori London the World Health Organization has issued a dire warning that Ukraine's health system will come under enormous stress and millions of civilians will be at risk of increased illness during the long, brutally cold winter ahead.
This is the second year of the second winter of war, and the health situation in Ukraine is very dire. The World Health Organization says that millions of civilians are at risk of increased illnesses, and the number of potential deaths is also likely to increase. Children and elderly are suffering particularly, as you can imagine, struggling as the winter arrives. And one of the interesting things that a WHO representative in Ukraine, Yarno Habich, had to say was that even if the war ended today, the health needs of millions of people across Ukraine will increase. It was at a fairly low level in many respects before the war broke out, and it's only got worse since.
What are some of the particular issues that are causing the health system to potentially be under enormous stress?
Well, of course, the fighting is the main concern that makes everything very bad. And because of the very cold weather, infectious diseases and chronic illnesses, people who have non-communicable diseases like heart disease and diabetes, respiratory illnesses and so forth, will only get worse because the weather in Ukraine in the winter is very, very, very cold. It's below freezing, and the shelter that many of these people have, you have to remember that there are millions of people who have been uprooted by the war. They are displaced persons within their own country, and they don't have the kind of proper heating that is needed in order to protect them from the cold. And so there is a great concern about the increase in disease. But I would say that perhaps the number one problem or number one concern that the World Health Organization has is the extent of mental illness within the population. The WHO, in fact, has a report that says that more than 10 million people in Ukraine have mental health problems. And it's having a particularly devastating impact on Ukraine's 7.5 million children who are not only suffering from mental health problems, but also the lack of nutritious food and not having life-saving vaccinations. And there is a great concern that, coming back to the children, that the mental health, the anxieties that they are going through right now is a situation that is going to last at least for another generation.
And of course, the situation is dire due to Russia's continued assaults on the Ukraine power grid and the potential for people to have light and heat.
This is a very real concern. We haven't begun to see the worst of it. It's only in the beginning, but already there have been attacks against some of the power grid in Ukraine. As you recall, last year it created a huge problem in terms of knocking out the electricity and the heating systems throughout the country. And as we are going into winter and it's going to be freezing cold weather, this is not good news at all. And so having gone through this situation, administration once last year. People in Ukraine are a little bit more prepared for the same thing happening this year.
That was VOA's Lori London talking with VOA correspondent Lisa Schlein in Geneva. Lengthy delays at the polls have forced officials to extend voting in Congo's presidential election to Thursday. Many voters in the Western African country struggled to cast ballots because of steep logistical and security challenges, raising concerns about the election's credibility. Associated Press reporter Charles de la Desma reports on the Congo elections.
Congo is seeing opening delays of up to 7 hours in a presidential election facing steep logistical and security challenges. Some ballots are so smudged they are illegible, and some people say they can't find their names on voting rolls. Some 44 million people, or almost half the population, are expected to vote, but experts and locals have warned such challenges could affect the credibility of the vote in a country whose mineral resources are increasingly crucial to the global economy. President Felix Tshisekedi seeks his second and final five-year term, running against 26 on the ballot. His main rival appears to be Moise Katumbi, a millionaire businessman. I'm Charles de la Desma.
The European Commission has recently recommended opening negotiations for Ukraine and Moldova to join the European Union. And the smaller Moldova, like its northern neighbor, Ukraine, is also contending with Russian troops inside its borders. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports from Chisinau.
As Russian forces strike across Ukraine's sovereign territory, neighboring Moldova has been caught in the crossfire.
In the beginning, we have several violations of our airspace. Unfortunately, we have even some remains of the missiles that fell down on our territories.
But Moldovan Defense Minister Anatoly Nasati and other top military leaders tell VOA that despite a war raging to the east, the most immediate security issue is already within Moldova's borders. Brigadier General Sergiu Cherempei is the deputy chief of Moldova's general staff.
The biggest threat is coming from Transnistria and the Russian elements that are there.
Sealed off by the Dniester River, Transnistria is a separatist region supported by Russia. Roughly 1,500 Russian troops are still stationed there.
Are you filming here?
We encountered some as we crossed the river.
We're at a Moldovan checkpoint at the autonomous Transnistria region, which is internationally recognized as Moldovan territory. But a few hundred meters in front of me, Russian forces are manning another checkpoint. They call themselves peacekeepers, and they have a say over who gets in and out.
For our security and to prevent another tense encounter with Russian troops, Moldovan border security on the Transnistria side escorted VOA without incident as we recrossed the river in the direction of Chisinau. Russia promised to withdraw its troops from Moldova in international agreements signed in 1994 and 1999. But Moscow never fulfilled its promises. Adrian Efros is Moldova's Minister of Internal Affairs.
This is a big security issue. We have those troops on our territory and we have a war just close to our borders. So the security situation is very fragile, let's say like this, in Moldova.
The security challenges come as the European Commission on November 8th recommended opening negotiations for Moldova and Ukraine to join the EU. Chisinau says that while Moscow uses its military arsenal to attack Kyiv, the Kremlin is using every non-military tool in its arsenal to dash Moldova's Western aspirations. Tensions between Russia and Moldova have skyrocketed. Over the summer, Chisinau expelled 45 diplomats and staff from the Russian embassy for what it said was unfriendly actions, and Moldova has repeatedly accused Russia of hybrid warfare. Again, Defense Minister Nasati.
It's not about accusation. We can feel the effects of this hybrid war every day. During the winter, when they cut out the supply of gas, and when they're bombing the critical infrastructure of the Ukraine, that is directly linked to our infrastructure, so we have a blackout here as well.
Moldova's Minister of Internal Affairs, Adrian Efros, says it's also about disrupting their information space.
They make this hybrid war more intense, with more disinformation, with more cyber attacks. They try to make the tension between different regions of Moldova to make this tension internally.
U.S. Ambassador to Moldova Kent Logsdon says Moldova is experiencing a historic moment.
If you think about all of the countries around Moldova looking to the west, those countries all joined NATO, they joined the EU, and now Moldova kind of missed the bus, if you will. They saw it go by and they think this is their chance.
Moldova is now seen as the front runner for EU membership, with negotiations expected to start later this year. Carla Babb, VOA News, Chisinau.
New York will be the second U.S. state to set up a commission to consider reparations for slavery. The first was California. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
New York's governor signs a bill creating a commission to study reparations for slavery. Governor Kathy Hochul getting applause for her action, saying the bill makes it possible for reasoned debate about what the future of any reparations should look like.
To those who think that even having this conversation is unfair or wrong, I say it would be wrong not to have it.
She says slavery was not just a Southern issue.
What is hard to embrace is the fact that our state also flourished from that slavery.
Reverend Al Sharpton calls the commission historic.
I do not know where the commission will go, but I know that history is made because there is a commission and there is a recognition. And sometimes, even if you can't take away the pain and the scar, we gain a lot by being recognized.
California became the first state to form a reparations task force, and others are considering similar legislation. Julie Walker, New York.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield expressed regret that so little has changed in South Sudan in the past 6 months. The United States agrees that a lack of political will is the root cause of this intransigence, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. Indeed, the same issues identified 6 months ago remain unresolved.
Basic questions around who will vote, how they will vote, and which levels of government they will vote for are all still unanswered. When the transitional government has done so little to prepare for elections, providing additional funding for these elections sends absolutely the wrong message.
Future funding must be coupled with a renewed push on the South Sudan peace process and improved humanitarian access, stressed Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. The transitional government of South Sudan has income from its oil resources to fund government services, noted Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield.
The South Sudanese people have a fundamental right to know how their country's oil money is being spent and to benefit from how their country's oil money is being spent. And so the transitional government must start using public revenue transparently for appropriate public purposes.
In addition, we remain concerned by the high level of violence, criminality, and human rights abuses in South Sudan, stated Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield.
We designated Gordon Kwang Biel, Galiak Nyang Hof, and Joseph Matiel Wajiang as responsible for systematic rape and other human rights violations perpetrated against women and girls during armed attacks in Lear County of Unity State. These armed groups use sexual slavery, including rape and gang rape, of abducted women and girls as an incentive and reward for combatants. This is unimaginably cruel. And so we call on President Kiir to fulfill his pledge to hold those who committed these unthinkable acts accountable.
The South Sudanese transitional government faces a number of choices, whether to achieve the commitments in the 2018 peace agreement that are necessary for it to hold free and fair elections in 12 months, whether to use its abundant public revenue to make sure the Sudanese people have enough food, and whether to hold perpetrators of human rights violations accountable. The United States once again calls on the government of South Sudan to make the right choices. 12 years after achieving its independence, it is way past time for the transitional government to chart a new path.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.